Hello and welcome to this episode of the Fitness Unfiltered podcast. I am with my two co-hosts, Mike and Dan. Mike, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Dan, how are
I'm
you?
Fine also, thank you.
Okay, good. Right. And now on to the important guest that we have, who I have been a big fan of for many, many years. Way back when it was mostly, I think, via Propane Fitness that I heard about you. It is Chris Williams. How are you?
Chris Williams' son.
Oh my God. Do you know
That's
what?
Fine.
In my head, I was like,
say this it right. Say it right. Like, it's fine.
This is 50-50, and I'm just going to go with it. And then I'm a massive fan saying his
You'd
name.
Just
wrong.
Double down him.
But can like, I just say
had an like, argument about it? Like, no, that's not.
I know you're sure that it is Chris Williamson.
It is definitely
and I start
Chris
questioning
Williamson.
Myself. You're gaslighting me about my own name, and we've only been 1 minute into this podcast.
Because do you know, like, actually, like, I've had this problem because I just thought you were called like Chris Willis initially because your Instagram name is like Chris Will.
That's what happened to me as well. It's your Instagram name. That's what it
yeah,
was.
Yeah, and then when I found out it was Williamson, I was like, oh my God. It's a totally different name than I thought. And then I then got paranoid that I was getting it wrong every time I thought about it. And then I ended up in like this vicious circle of incorrectness, which is my least favorite type of vicious
well, Mike,
circle of all
cute.
Of
it. It's cute for me to know that you're often thinking about me sufficiently so that it causes you problems that you worry whether you get my surname wrong.
It's
a challenge. Everyone that's out there who has like a name which comes in multiple different versions, like, you know, it's a Zach with a CH, he's Zach with a K. Like,
I get a lot of Osmond.
I can imagine so. Yeah.
Osmond.
Yeah. Also
I get a
from
lot of
me.
Banana.
Yeah, also from you. Yeah.
Exactly.
Banana. Very true, yeah.
There's a I bit get of a banana thing. All the time. Is your name Dr. Banana? No, that would be ridiculous, wouldn't it? Anyway.
So, just can I ask a first question? What is it like to see a professional outlet and podcast in action?
It's very slick, incredibly professional. Yeah, it feels like I'm on Joe Rogan.
I would actually. With
We've
your
heard
setup,
that before.
Would it be fair to say you're heading that way? The UK's Joe Rogan.
That guy
That's
unbraised, is,
isn't it?
Yeah, that to even be mentioned in the same sentence as him is a, and also like his reach is. So much bigger than anyone's, even when you get to like the top leagues, the Peter Crouches, the Freddie Flintoffs, the True Geordies of the UK. The reach that Rogan has is so much greater. But I like to think that I'm the hardest working podcaster in the UK. I don't think that there's anyone else that puts out the same volume and quality of guests that I do. And that's something that I can pride myself on because the platform will come for as long as I continue getting things right. So yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, I run a podcast called Modern Wisdom, and during the last 6 to 9 months, I guess, of 2020, I've really, really sort of put my foot on the gas there. And last month we had 1.6 million downloads, which was more than we'd done in the first 2 years of the show. So kind of the return curve is kicking off, and I just like talking to interesting people like yourselves.
Yeah, because, I mean, you do get some... You seem like a curious guy. You get some really fascinating people. I really enjoyed the Douglas Murray episode. I think I messaged you to tell you that. That had a few opinions. That was a really interesting episode. But it's... Because we find with this as well, because although we're called fitness, we'd like to speak to people that, you know, we're curious about learning from others, what they know, what they think, what they feel, because you can get kind of caught in your own little echo chambers, I think, and not expose yourself to any of that. What turned your, I guess, what was probably a little bit of a hobby and passion piece into more than that, purpose, fulfillment? Because I mean, you might be in a slightly different position now, but I know with the podcast and what we do it just because we get so much return from it, from not financially, just because we enjoy talking to people.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same for me. If you gave me the opportunity to choose to do anything at 6 o'clock most weekday evenings, it would be... have a conversation with a porn star or the girl that starts the UK version of OnlyFans or a guy who's trying to message extraterrestrials or a guy who's going to row the Atlantic solo or, you know what I mean? Like that to me sounds like a really lovely way to spend an evening. And it just happens to be now that by some weird quirk, some odd code breakup in this version of the simulation that I actually get to call that a job and a project now, as opposed to just a thing that satisfies my own desire to be nosy. And yeah, you can kind of cultivate an audience of people that resonate with what you say, and then they get to kind of, they benefit from your curiosity, and you get to hear their suggestions about who you should reach out to. And it's all this big weird sort of circle jerk masturbation fest of everyone satisfying their own desire to learn more. And I love it, man. I think it's a wonderful platform, and long may it continue.
Yeah, you've taken the red pill and there's no going back.
It's interesting as well, because I think like there is a thirst for knowledge in a way that there hasn't necessarily been for a long time. And it was actually something that on the Joe Rogan podcast with Jordan Peterson that they mentioned, that, you know, now we have people doing like world tours for books and like lecture circuits and stuff like that. And that hasn't really been popular for a very long time. And it does seem to be like that with all of the misinformation that's out there and all of the, you know, pointless and shallow discussions and sort of forms of entertainment that we often engage in, there does seem to be this rise in that kind of, in that hunger for something a little bit more substantial. And I suppose like how have you noticed that that's kind of informed the type of topics that you touch on? Because I mean, you go deep into some great stuff. Like, I mean, I was just listening to your the Stoic Philosophy podcast the other day, and I thought that was great, because like you're talking to someone and you're like, give me your top three Stoic philosophers. And I'm like, this is such an amazing way of making something that's actually incredibly highbrow and incredibly complicated actually just be super easy to listen to for someone who's just on a car journey, and actually, you know, relating it to stories that we hear every day.
Yeah. Being honest, man, I will talk to anyone that's interesting. Like I say, I had a guy that's an ethical hacker on. I had a guy called David Pierce, who is one of the foremost intellect when it comes to the transhumanism movement, basically how we will transcend our humanity and become post-human beings, whether that be augmented through artificial intelligence or through pharmacology or whatever it might be. Like, I just want to know what they've got to say. And for a very long time, I was quite ashamed of my intellectual curiosity. I grew up being a club promoter, which was my bread and butter, and sort of my formative years as a businessman from university until about 27, when I fatedly went on to Love Island. That period was a lot of being a big name on campus, kind of like very ego-driven. And there was part of me that always had this intellectual curiosity, but it was never being satisfied. And then this latent curiosity that's been pent up for the last however long, like since I read the seventh Harry Potter book when I was in school or something, like all of that period was just not satisfied at all. And now I am paying back for that, I suppose, three or four times a week.
It's interesting, yeah. You mentioned that, because I had no idea that you had been on Love Island for like a very, very long time, which is, I imagine, is perhaps part of your process, really, in the sense that you're doing very, very different stuff to what you were doing before.
So but even the trip onto Love Island was built out of curiosity. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted to know what it was like to live in a villa with cameras on you 24/7. I mean, I did take me out for exactly this. It's just FOMO. I just want to know what it's like. What's it like to meet Paddy McGuinness?
What was it like?
Which one, Paddy McGuinness or
how fake is Love Island? 100% fake.
No, so they don't script anything. Obviously, I can only give you an experience from one season, and there's been like five or something now. But on my season, there was a villa producer who will come in and poke storylines. So like, let's say that me and Mike have had an argument because we both fancy Dan, and she'll say like, look, what I really think that you should do is have a chat with Mike. Like, why don't you go over toward the fire pit, and when you go over there, there'll be cameras and stuff set up, but very much the storylines are emergent. And here's the here is the razor for everybody to use, right? Do you think that Stacy, 19-year-old hairdresser from Rochester, has the capacity to be able to fully deploy emotions on command that are scripted by some company? Like, these people aren't trained actors. They're just plucking random UK citizens out of obscurity, throwing them into a villa in a tiny pair of swim shorts and saying, like, good luck. The people that are in there are not sufficiently sophisticated in terms of acting ability to be able to do that. And it's like, the things that people do try, that everyone wants to be Alex Jones, right? Everyone wants to find the conspiracy theory at the moment. There's like this scene a couple of years ago where they were like, look, look at this. On this angle, they both stand up at the same time, but on this angle, she stands up before him. This is obvious. That it's like, mate, it's called a match and action. It's the most basic type of cinematography that you will ever see. The fact that they don't have two of the same camera guys at the same time and said, hi guys, would you mind standing up again? They didn't ask him to not say, I love you, and instead say I hate you. They just said, will you stand up twice so we can get it from two different angles because it's a TV show. So yeah, don't worry about that. We didn't know what time of day it was. We didn't have access to the internet. It's really boring for the most part.
You didn't know what time of day it was?
Change the time on all of the clocks and all of the phones that you've got have the wrong time on. And then the people that come and change. We didn't get told why. My hypothesis is that it means they can better control your sleep and wake cycle without you knowing if you've not slept enough or if you've slept like too much.
Oh, because they're like, we want more footage.
Potentially
like,
heightened emotions.
And the opposite of that as well. Like the first night that we were in there, we were all excited, stayed up until late, and then woke up on the morning and they came over the tannoy. Like once one person's up, everyone's up. That's what happens when you sleep in a bedroom that's only one bedroom with like 14 people in. Except for me, because I'd snuck earplugs in and a face mask. So I was sweet. Once one person's up, everyone's up, and they came over the tannoy and said, bing boo, excuse me, Islanders, you have been asleep for 3.5 hours. Can everyone please go back to bed? Because we had no idea. So conversely, you might have a lot of people who think, I'm hard as fuck. Like I've been asleep for 3.5 hours. I'll crack on. Whereas they can actually try and remind you that you probably do need a bit of kip.
And back there, when you get that curiosity for speaking to other people, did you, you know, it's difficult to say whether it's like a premeditated thing. Did you have the foresight to think that, you know, I've got this potentially passion piece in which I want to talk to these really interesting people. This might help me platform wise in terms of exposure and having access to others.
Oh, no, totally emergent, man.
Oh, really?
Totally emergent. Yeah. And it is for so many people. Like we look at the great successes of this world as if the all of the steps that they took to get there was perfectly planned out and they'd seen the vision before it happened. Like, nah, I went on the Propane Fitness podcast, really enjoyed talking to Johnny and Youssef. It was like, I want to do it more. How can I facilitate this passion? If I do it myself, I can do it as much as I want. Then did it once a week for the first year, did it twice a week for the second year, did it three times a week around about for the third year. And that's literally it. And then upon looking back, you go, well, obviously the podcasting market has grown. It was very like I positioned myself cleverly because I got big names on early, which then facilitated me getting them on down. And now I'm getting repeat guests like Douglas Murray's been on twice and Andrew Doyle's been on twice. And Robert Greene got me Ryan Holiday and Ryan Holiday's got me like this thing and blah, 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 blah. Like it's not that at all. It's just controlled falling. And this is like the behind the curtain of almost every successful looking project is that almost everyone doesn't have a clue what they're doing. No one has a clue what they're doing at all times. Yeah, they're just, it's controlled falling. Like at the very, very beginning of your adulthood, you're at a big, big set of stairs and someone just pushes you like that at the top of the stairs and you just try not to fall down for the next 70 years. And then if you manage to make it to the end without falling down, everyone looks back and goes, oh, well played, mate. Well played, really. So just beautiful, gracious stuff.
Yeah, I find this really, really interesting because all of the successful people that I know bang on at me about how I need to develop my goals and I need to have very clearly defined goals and I need to be working towards those goals and that's how it has to be. Whereas I work much more on that sort of pattern in like, here is an opportunity, I would like to explore it. I want to do this, I want to do this, I want to do this, kind of letting it unfold like that. Do you still, even though you've done it in that way, do you still clearly have defined goals? And do you, how do you respond to that? And I'm asking you this because that will help me answer these people when the next time they have a go at me for not, when they go, what are your goals? And they go, I don't know, I just want to just like be happy.
Yeah. I think anyone that reads Atomic Habits by James Clear can become quite disparaging about goals very quickly. So they can say, you do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems, which is great. But growth without goals is pointless. And if anyone wants to find out a little bit more about this, if you feel like you've taken too much of the James Clear red pill, I can give you the counter for that, which is if you just search There Is No Growth Without Goals, Chris Sparks on Google, it'll come up. It's a wonderful article. And basically, it reminds us that if you are a growth-minded person, a lot of the guys and girls that will be listening to this show, I'm going to guess will be, as most of you are, and just this kind of, directionless, growth by any means, growth at any costs approach, which we can often have to life, is just kind of like wasteful, directionless optimization. Like, what are you optimizing your life for? And very much so, if you don't have values that's emerging from, you can end up spending a lot of time working on becoming better, but moving in no direction at all. I think those two, as with almost everything, somewhere in the middle, that it works in tandem. It's a good idea to have values that you hold on to and are very, very rigid. What are the core drivers in your life? What is the reason that you're on this planet? Mine are curiosity, excellence, selfless development, adventure, and self-care. That's mine. So everything that I do in my life in some way is built out of those five things. And as long as the stuff that I do feeds into that or is driven from that, I know that I'm on a fairly good path. Now, I don't know whether the podcast is going to become like the main thing that I do in my life and I'm going to not be able to have, you know, time to eat or sleep or do anything else in 2 years time, but I know that it feeds my curiosity, it allows me to have a sense of adventure, it improves selfless development, it gives me an outlet for excellence, and it for me is a form of therapy, talking precisely, so it does self-care, so it ticks all five boxes. So for as long as that's happening, like, I don't really care. And again, as with most things, if you find something that you're truly passionate about, you can very, very quickly become great at it. You can outwork the best, the hardest working people in the room. And to you, it won't even feel like work. To them, they'll have to do 16 hours a day banging their head again. Like, the way that I've spent my day is editing 5 episodes and uploading them. Like, dealing with the advertisers, like this, the dealing with advertisers bit's a little bit less fun. But, like, recording the intros and editing and reminding myself of all of the stuff that I learned and then synthesizing that into the show notes and putting it up. To some people, that would sound like hell. Or dedicating an hour and a half every weekday night to speaking to someone would be like, oh, God, I just want to go to the gym or sit on the couch or do whatever it is, anything else. But for me, it's not. So I'll happily outwork everyone in the room because to me, it doesn't feel like work. And that really is like the secret to success. Find what for you feels like play, but to everybody else looks like work. Then you look like you're doing so much hard work, but you're not, you're just dicking about.
Yeah, and I guess that's the fulfillment side.
I love that, but how, so say you're someone, now Mike, I'm not saying this is totally you, but if you're someone who doesn't know what that is yet, right, so if you're someone who's like, I don't know what my goals are, I don't know what I'm working towards, like, would you recommend, it seems like you would recommend like a little bit of soul searching as to what your values are and then let your goals grow from your values. Is that like a good place to start?
Massively so. So a great book for you to read, anyone that feels like this is where they're at, is The Almanac of Naval Ravikant, which just came out last week. It's free at navalmanacck.com. Eric Jorgensen came on my show, a wonderful episode, great guy. Basically, you need to he's a real wise human. You need to explore before you exploit, and you need to spend a lot of time working out what it is that you enjoy. Some good prompts for this are Google Chris Sparks core values, Chris Sparks experiment without limits, which is that experiment without limits is the best workbook I've ever seen in my life and should cost 500 quid and it's free. And you can get it in print form off Amazon for about a tenner as well. It's phenomenal. Or Taylor Pearson core values, another good thing to Google. All of this is stuff that I've done. And you, upon spending time reflecting and doing proper, like, formalized introspective work, all of this stuff, you start to like open doors inside of yourself that you didn't know were there. Like, you've been with you for your entire life. And then upon discovering that there's a bit of you that you didn't know was there, you're like, oh, shit, that you played a computer game for ages and didn't realize that there was this special move that you could do. And then once you do, it's always there and it informs all of the future special moves that you do. So yeah, explore before you exploit. Greg McKeown, Reading Essentialism by Greg McKeown, is a wonderful prompt for this. So like, what is the highest point of contribution that you can do? And again, the sad fact of being someone who is capable and has a variety of interests is that your the breadth of interests that you have also makes deciding quite difficult, and that can be self-defeating.
And I think I'm sure you've had similar conversations with Yusuf, because obviously, like, coming from a medical background, I chat to him quite a lot about this sort of stuff as well. And it's really interesting when you've been on this sort of like, in medicine, you are on a conveyor belt of your career. You push a button when you're 18, and then you're just like, you come out of this factory at the end. And it's all just laid out on a plate in front of you. So there isn't, I mean, there are moments where you have to consider whether you like this bit more than that bit, but really they're all kind of the same anyway. You're still, you know, you are doing the same kind of job. You're just doing it in slightly different environments. So it's really weird to kind of come to the end of this sort of 11-year process, which, you know, that Yusuf is obviously kind of midway through, and which direction he'll go will be very interesting to watch unfold. But you come out the end of it and you're suddenly like, oh, I can do whatever I like now. What's that? Don't know, because I've never really had to really consider it.
There is an equivalent midlife crisis that occurs as people get out of university. They've been on guide rails for 11 years, 13 years, 15 years of their life. And then they're just deposited into the world and told that they now need to take control of the wheel. You're like, holy, like, what? Are you being serious? Like, I was a kid. I was a child 3 years ago or 5 years ago, whatever. And now you're expecting me to somehow know the direction of my life. I mean, a couple of other good prompts that helped me. What do people come to you for? Like, so why do people come to you? What are some of the things that people ask you to do? So for instance, let's say that people often come to you with gossip. Perhaps you would make a good journalist. Perhaps people often come to you for advice. Perhaps you'd make a good coach. Perhaps people often come to you because they just feel like they need someone to talk to. Maybe you'd make a good podcaster or whatever it might be. Those are some areas. Another one that's really, really good is, what did you do between the ages of about 8 and 14 just for fun? So I'm an only child, and one of the things that I used to do is I listened to a lot of audio tapes. So every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, I'd go back to the library with my mum and get, like, on, you know, like, old 8-bit tape player, like Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy or something like that. And I'd sit and I'd listen to those while I was playing in my room or drawing or doing homework or whatever it might be. Like, what is the 2020 equivalent of listening to audio tapes? It's a podcast. Like, I get to do, I'm enacting what I did as a kid. It's this great story of one of the best color pickers on the planet. So this lady who is employed by huge interior design companies and some of the best clothing designers on the planet to create perfect color palettes, this to blend with this, to blend with this. And then that's what they put forward onto their adverts, or they use it for clothing. And she got interviewed and was asked, like, so what are the qualifications? Like, why are you the best color picker on the planet? Like, what is it that gives you the X factor? She said, well, I'm not formally trained at all. And essentially all I've ever done is just learn on the job. But when I was 10 years old, my mom and dad got me the biggest Crayola set that was available. And I just obsessed over it for years and years and years. And look at that. Like, there you go. So that's something else to consider. Those are some prompts that have kind of helped me.
Dan, what would you be? Like, what were you doing between, what is it, the age of 8 and 14?
Yeah.
What was I doing? God, I can't even remember. I used to read Goosebumps books every spare second of the day I had.
So a Ghostbuster?
Goosebumps. Oh, no. Do you know what? This is one of those really embarrassing things. So I tried to use Matrix analogy when talking to someone younger the other day. They had no idea what I was, and it was the red pill, the blue pill one. They had no idea what I was talking about. You've never read a Goosebumps book?
No.
Please tell me you both have.
I was more of a point horror man myself, I must admit, but there we go.
Yeah, so I used to obsess over horror reading books, horror books.
And now you're a personal trainer.
Yeah. I don't know how that's worked. Well, actually, so working with some people has been a good horror game. Yeah, I guess that has worked out. No, but I guess, like, from what you're talking about, Chris, that self-exploration takes some work, but also some self-awareness that I don't always think people have. Because this is something we were talking about just before we came on the podcast, actually, and that self-development is kind of on trend at the moment, but you almost have this, for want of a better phrase, self-masturbatory self-development, in which people just collect, but they don't actually do that inner exploration. They don't then apply that to that further fulfillment, that further purpose they have for the world.
You just read the books and post about them on Instagram.
Yeah, I read this really great. Yeah.
Dude, it's, yeah. I mean, with every culture, there's a counterculture and there's various splinter factions within it. And most of them are filled with arseholes, like, which is just such an unfortunate fact of being humans, that for everything that's virtuous and beautiful, there is a bunch of dicks who are going to come in and ruin it. And again, to quote Naval Ravikant from that Navalmanac, if you're so smart, why aren't you happy? That's a question that everyone that thinks that they're clever should ask themselves. Mm. If you're so smart, why aren't you happy? And the same thing goes for, if you're so well-read, why aren't you happy?
Mm.
If your car's so nice and your missus is so good-looking and your trainers are so new, why aren't you happy? Because all of those things are done in service of ultimately making you feel happy. And if what you're doing isn't giving you that outcome, like, yeah. I don't need to be the person that says you're going down the wrong path. You know that yourself. But sadly, because there is an asymmetry between what people feel and what they show us, and that has been exacerbated with social media, in that we get to see the highlight reel of everybody else's life, but we get to see the blunder reel of our own from a front row seat. We presume that everyone else lives this sort of bizarre, perfect, flawless 6.6, 6.6, 6.6 life, when ours is just constantly stepping in dog shit and falling flat on our face and being incompetent and nowhere near as confident or able as anyone that's around us.
Mm-hmm.
But when you actually look at what people do, like what are the outcomes that people get in life? The vast majority of people that you look up to, you don't want to be them anyway.
Yeah. It's definitely an interesting one, because we've had chats about it as well. I think it's because a lot to do with that is, as you said, with social media, people's perceptions of what success looks like is skewed. Like they base what they think success should be on what other people are doing, not necessarily those values you mentioned, not necessarily what they want, but what they truly feel they deserve in life to make them happy and what they can give back to others as well.
Yeah, massively so.
I have an interesting question, just as a little interlude just there. Talk to me about Halloween saurine loaves. Which is your favourite?
The chocolate and blood orange one, man.
Absolutely. Sorry, thank I'm you. With you there.
I was going to say apple.
But they quite happily turn into a snackcident.
But then you'd be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, you're welcome to your opinion, Emma, but...
You're wrong.
Yeah. It's wrong. I want a chocolate banana version. I feel like they've really missed a trick with that. And I feel that what has always really surprised me about them is that when... Because there's a strawberry one, and the texture of the strawberry one is so infinitely superior to the texture of any of the other ones. It's so much softer and more perfect. It really upsets me whenever I have any of the other varieties now.
You also have to think the strawberry one is only available in lunchbox loaves. You can't get a big block of the strawberry one, and I wonder whether the process of making it into a brick loses some of the texture. I'm with you.
Maybe.
I haven't had a full diabetes as well, I think.
But what did you say? It's good for diabetes?
No, risk of diabetes and contributing to the national obesity pandemic, because...
Very
that
carby.
Stuff just goes down.
Very carby. Yeah. I remember I was driving to one of our club nights in Manchester, and I was like bulking, and that which means just having two saurine loaves a day. And I was driving, and I had a banana one, just like not the huge one, but like the good sized one. And I opened the wrapper and started eating it, and the guy that was in the passenger seat looked at me in horror, like I'd just pulled like a raw pepper out. And was starting to eat a raw pepper or something, or like a sausage, like an uncooked sausage. And he's just looking at me, and I'm like, what's wrong? He's like, are you seriously doing that? I'm like, what do you mean? It's not like a loaf of bread. I know that it says on the side malt loaf, but it's not. It's totally different, and you're wrong. And in 3 seconds, it'll be gone. So like,
stop judging me.
Stop looking at me.
Have you, I don't mean to go super off topic on this, but have you tried the packets of that come with like two slices of buttered Soreen. Mm-hmm. They're really bad and disappointing, I think. I was devastated by that.
They're in the they're the only thing that I'll get on the meal deal in WH Smith's in the departure lounge of Newcastle Airport. The only time I'll ever have them.
Special.
Spent a fair bit of time in airports last year.
Have you ever toasted them?
Yeah, of course. Oh, you're not talking
when I'm ridiculous question.
Yeah, I feel like he's like a malt loaf professional. I don't think we should be asking questions like that.
I was going to ask you, Chris, on the nightlife side of it, obviously things are postponed at the moment, so I'm not going to go down the predictable, inevitable route of line of questioning there, because that obviously affects things for you. But from a evolutionary point of view and our bare primitive selves and the social aspects that your nightlife scene offered people, how much do you think that's affecting people at the moment?
That's a good question. I think that 2020 is the first year where there's been a competitive advantage to being an introvert, which is really interesting, because for almost every other year that everyone's been alive, being extroverted means that you have greater opportunities for networking, you're more personable, you're more likable easily, you can just spend more time around other people, which magnifies the force multiplier of your networking effect. And this year, all of that's been stopped. And those of us who are capable of working in solitude, or perhaps even get their energy from being in solitude, have had a competitive advantage. Now, even me, only child, solo podcaster, business owner, all the rest of the stuff, solitude's been pushed to an extreme in 2020. And for those people who are listening that do get their energy from being around other people, I feel very sorry for you, because it must be tough. With regards to the club nights thing, my personal opinion is that we should have and still should be taking the pandemic more seriously. The fact that it's got a mortality rate of under 1% is purely a twist of luck. I've been reading a lot of existential risk work this year, specifically Toby Ord's The Precipice, and he gives humanity the likelihood of us reaching our full potential as a civilization, spacefaring, galaxy colonizing at 1 in 2, and he gives the chance that we survive the next century at 1 in 3. So the vast, vast, vast majority of our existential risk from the smartest X-risk analysis on the planet occurs within the next 100 years, and people are pissing about the fact that I can't go to the pub with my mates after 10 o'clock. Like, mate, get a grip. There's trillions and trillions and trillions of human lives who are on the other side of us making it through the next 100 to 500 years. Like, the challenge is...
Why is it that he thinks that next 100 to 500 years? And also, just before you go into that, can you just briefly explain what existential risk is?
So existential risk is the permanent neutering of humanity's ability to reach our full potential. So that would either be everyone on the planet being wiped out, or there being a permanent and significant stop in our ability to ever reach our full potential, which is galaxy colonizing, spacefaring, multi-planet civilization, etc., etc. The reason that he thinks it's going to happen within the next century is incredibly key, is that this is going to be the period in which most experts think artificial general intelligence will get to human or superhuman levels. And if you have artificial general intelligence before you have sorted what's called the control problem or the alignment problem, i.e. the goals of the AGI are the same as the goals of humanity, you can very quickly get perverse incentives whereby the AGI just turns all humans into matter, or you give it the goal of make all humans happy, so it just sticks electrodes into our faces and forces us to smile like this, or puts us in vats and puts us on a cocktail of drugs of MDMA constantly for the rest of our lives. Like, those are things that are perverse incentives. They're not what we want, but they're kind of, they fulfill the goal. The same thing goes for the number of bioweapons leaks that have occurred in the last 100 years is mental. And they've just about been fixed. Like, someone weaponized smallpox. Let's not forget that we finished smallpox, got rid of it, and they kept it alive, frozen. And then they managed to do it with the Spanish flu and all sorts of other stuff. And it's like the air conditioning stopped working, so this special fan came on and blew it through the ceiling, and then people in the town next door, all of this sort of stuff. The long and short of it is that I think if everyone had a better understanding of our common humanity, our individual problems would feel a lot less large. And unfortunately, the discomfort of being trapped in your house on your own is really, really high. But everyone needs to remember that what they have now, even during a pandemic, is only what Louis XIV could have dreamed of. Like, you're warm in winter and cold in summer. Like, just that fact with warm running water is an absolute game changer. But because naturally we are relativistic beings, we move our goals in time with whatever is happening around us, and we very, very quickly forget the fact that we've got serious problems. People get back to, you know, being upset that they can't go play squash or rugby or whatever. My housemate's the physio for Newcastle Falcons, and he hasn't been able to see a rugby game in like 7 months. And it's uncomfortable, man. Like, you know, this isn't me downplaying the fact that it's challenging for people to live through a pandemic. My point is that this might be the sacrifice that you have to make so that we as a civilization can move a little bit further forward. I appreciate if you haven't fully taken the existential risk red pill the same way that I have, that kind of doesn't really feel like much of a comfort. But you can at least know that any sacrifices and discomfort that you are going through is worthwhile.
I think that the difficulty that people have is that, like, it's very easy for us to say that because we believe it to be the case. So we believe that the pandemic is a real threat. And we believe that those things are necessary in order for not necessarily our own survival, but the survival of people that we care about or people that we don't even know about yet. But we think that's an important enough reason to do it. I think that part of the problem is that level of misinformation, number one, so that there are many people who don't think that's necessary, but then also the fact that a lot of the restrictions that are being suggested and offered are being criticized also by very clever people who are also pointing out the other forms of harm that those things can cause as well, and then are making very compelling arguments for the fact that the relative risks of those two different pathways are different. And I think that the difficulty is with that is that what's ultimately happening is that it's that uncertainty and that disagreement isn't causing people to act differently, it's causing people to feel differently. So they don't, their ultimate outcome is that they don't believe that it's as much of a threat as they realize. So they're not doing the personal things that they need to do to try and keep themselves and those around them safe. And I think that's what is ultimately frustrating, because we don't have a massive say on what the government rules are and the guidelines are, but we do have a say on what we do with our own selves and our own families to a point.
Yeah, there's a really interesting study that was done at Heathrow Airport, and they wanted to reduce the number of complaints that they were getting as people were waiting in the queue to get their baggage checked. And Rory Sutherland, past Modern Wisdom guest and world famous behavioral economist, his company Ogilvy Advertising was brought in, and typical engineers at Heathrow, they were looking at it as an optimization problem. They were saying, right, well, if we can have pre-check this far down the queue, and if we actually rearrange the queue into an S shape with like a W horseshoe formation, and then we can fit more of the checkers in this way. And, you know, they looked at it as a typical engineer would. Whereas Rory Sutherland's team came in and said, before you do that, before you spend like, you know, 10 mil, can we just print some posters, please? So they fixed the entire problem, and the number of complaints went down by some insane amount, like more than 50%. And all that they did was put 45 minutes from this point, 30 minutes from this point, 15 minutes from this point, because the way that we work, we're anticipatory beings, right? We don't mind waiting. We just want to know how long the wait is. And for the entirety of this year, we haven't known when it's going to end. And sadly, no one does. But if there was a point, Boris, for instance, came out, it's really sort of come to a head this week, I think, oh my God, are we going back into a second lockdown? Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? And what was like one of the last rolls of the dice that Boris had to throw out the other day, where he said, I promise you that by October 2021, none of this will be in place. That was one of the things that he said. So that is very much 15 minutes from this point, 5 minutes from this point. That's what we've got to play with. And again, like, you know, this is inbuilt into us, the anticipatory desire that we have to know when the end is coming, when it'll all be normal again. We can't turn that off. But if you're aware of it, every time that you notice yourself feeling a little bit uncomfortable about the fact, oh, this just keeps going on, this just keeps going on. Okay. Like, you're aware of the fact that that is a particular hole you have in your, a chink that you have in your armor. Notice it and let it go.
Yeah,
that's so interesting.
Yeah, because I think it's how we we respond to risk as well, is that we can almost, as you said, put those measures in place once we better understand the end date. Because people are always thinking, oh, but I can book a holiday this time. And I know they're the minuscule things, but they're the minuscule things that keep people going. But as the selfish beings we are, we don't tend to look past our own noses sometimes.
It's hard another to be selfish, facet. Man.
Do you think that's part of every way that we've set up society? Yeah.
Yeah, like what, it's not even looking forward to something per se, but like there will, even if your goals change or your holidays change or plans change, whatever it is, and it, I don't think it's so much as, oh, I was working towards getting a great body for my holiday, or like working hard until my holiday in whenever it was. Like it's more just having a future something to like look forward to, where at the moment, like there really isn't any plans because it's an unknown. Like we don't know if there's going to, like we don't know what Christmas is going to be like. We don't know what,
I think,
like
people
what
have different,
really,
yeah. So I think people have different responses to fear as well. So like with all these deniers, it's, they're almost privying this knowledge. They have this knowledge that they've been exposed to that no one else is, because it's more comforting to think that you have all the answers, or it doesn't even exist, rather than just accept, I haven't got a fucking clue what's going on right
so
now.
Do you know, have you heard of the mental model compensatory control? Do you know what this is?
I think I've heard a little bit. I read a little bit on David's The Irrational Ape book.
Okay.
Have you read The Irrational
Ape? No, I haven't. No, so this was brilliant. I think I got this from, it was in the Telegraph or something at the start of the pandemic. Basically, people like to rationalize, everyone knows that, and compensatory control was identified as one of the reasons for the proliferation of conspiracy theories at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And the reason for that is that it's much easier for most of us to believe that COVID is the product of some malign scientist than the chance mutation of a silly little microbe. Mm-hmm. Like it shouldn't be the case that sheer chance can cause this much destruction, and applying a narrative to it still plays back. Like let's think about theology. Like what was that? What was religion for a very, very long time? It was people creating, like, the, you know, Thor with his hammer creating lightning. Like why would, but we personify, that's what humans do. Thomas the Tank Engine, as Jordan Peterson said when I saw him live, Thomas the Tank Engine has a face. Like, why does Thomas the Tank Engine need a face? He's a tank engine. But we do. We personify lots of things. And similarly, we try and come up with like a very easy to understand, oh, it's just human motivation. It's the malign scientist. It's the 5G towers because China are trying to turn the frogs gay or whatever. Like, it's just harder for us to believe that it's something that's done by chance. And the other thing as well, as you said about uncertainty moving forward, the Zeigarnik effect, which many of you may be familiar with, which is that the human brain hates open loops. So we always want to close a loop. It's the reason why TV shows on Netflix leave every episode with a cliffhanger, because you don't like the open loop. You want to know what happens next. And it's the same reason as to be continued in books and all the rest of stuff like that. And this is weaponized that, it's done it on a global scale. We don't know when it's going to end, so we can't have this anticipatory mechanism that's not being chilled out. And then also the Zeigarnik effect is coming in and kicking our ass. And then, a bit of Hanlon's razor and Occam's razor probably wouldn't go amiss if anyone wants to use those. So.
I can't believe you haven't read it, and I'm going to take great pride in it, because not that the listeners can see this, that massive stack of books you have in the background there for a man very well read. The Irrational Ape. We had David Grimes on our podcast, is a great read. But cool. My favorite conspiracy actually to come out of this whole process is Art Attack's Neil Buchanan is Banksy.
Yeah, being Banksy.
Yes.
I believe in it. I believe. I'm sticking
with it. Me too.
I want to believe.
Yeah, I choose
to
believe.
I want to believe in that. Yeah. That would be so brilliant.
Neil Buchanan really is a childhood hero, isn't he?
Yeah.
Was it Pat Sharp's Funhouse?
Yes.
Who can Pat Sharp be? Pat Sharp will have to, if Neil Buchanan is someone, Pat Sharp is someone else.
He'd
if
have to be
Pat
like
Sharp
Calvin
is...
Harris or something, wouldn't he?
No,
because
Pat Sharp can be like a QAnon.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah.
I feel like we're mentioning things that Emma's too young to know about now. Do you remember Fun
Act? Do you know what? I know Art Attack. I don't know.
You didn't experience Fun
House. Don't know Fun House.
Stop making us feel old, Emma.
Emma read books though when she was young, I think, as well. I think it's not
I'm pretty sure Emma read many more.
No,
books than
I didn't
I've ever
read. Like I don't read. Well, maybe I do now, but I never read when I was younger. My parents hate it so much because they're quite academic, and like my brother was a reader, and I just had no attention span for it whatsoever.
Terrible.
Like
I've always been terrible.
I don't think I ever finished a like storybook, fiction book.
So yours is more. Is it a habit now that do you set time aside, Chris, for your reading space? Because you must get through a fair lot. Because you've got I guess you've got to research your guest to a certain degree.
Very much so. I mean, again, for anyone who's listening that thinks, oh God, it sounds like this, like everyone's able to read books but me, my attention span was and is absolutely terrible. A big part of that was I'd got myself used to the level of stimulation I get from my phone. As a club promoter, my phone was the conduit for everything that I did. So I was spending, you know, upwards of 6 hours a day on WhatsApp and on Instagram and doing, you know, I would schedule the social media. As with a lot of businesses, you do the stuff that's on the ground floor before you can scale up and get people in and train them to do it for you. So I was doing everything. And the comeuppance of that was that I would sit down to read a one page of a book and I'd be fidgety. And I wouldn't be able to keep my eyes on a line. I'd have to like go back and read the same line multiple times. Remembering I did 2 degrees. I managed to get through 2 degrees at university. And then in the space of sort of 5 or 7 years, I'd just totally deprogrammed my capacity to sit in a quiet room and read something that wasn't a computer screen with bings and bongs and flashing images and full color and lights. But yeah, as with anything, the discomfort that's there is because it's doing something. This is something I learned from Ali Abdal, who's a big YouTuber and podcaster. I had him on the show this week, and he reminded me that learning is supposed to be hard. Like the difficulty that you feel in learning is the same as the difficulty when you go to the gym. If the training session that you do doesn't challenge you, it's not doing anything. And the same as if you go to read something and you're reading something and you're like, oh yeah, this is a piece of piss. Well, yeah, it's a children's book, or you know what I mean? Like it's not challenging you. So, and then just instantiating it. So my morning routine, I have 15 minutes of reading on a morning, and that plus maybe a little bit of time on an evening time will do me. And with that, you can get through so much, so much per year.
I'm getting through this on your recommendation. It's it's blowing my mind a little bit. I'm not that far in. I'm only about 100 pages.
What is it?
The Moral Animal by Robert Wright. It is one of the biggest red pill books that you can read.
I don't want to say making sense, like I've properly dissected and absorbed everything in there, but it's quite mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Because you're a big fan of evolutionary psychology as well, aren't you?
Massively so, yeah. Mostly because of that book.
Yeah, can you share some of that with our listeners? Because I think they would find that fascinating.
Of course, yeah. So the number one takeaway from The Moral Animal, I highly recommend that you read it. It's not a short read. You've just seen it by Dan picked it up there and he's had to use all of his strength to get it off the counter. It's probably about like 400 pages. Humans are not built to be happy. They're built to be effective. That is the takeaway from it. The human being is not built to be happy. It's built to be effective. And what is effective at keeping you alive and getting you to promulgate your genes, i.e. have offspring, might make you miserable. Like it genuinely might do. If there is a trait which makes you happy but decreases your reproductive fitness, it won't be passed on. If there is a trait which makes you existential crisis level misery, but improves your chances of reproductive fitness by 0.1%, it'll stick about.
We're constantly fighting our genetics.
Constantly, man. And this is, so Robert Wright's second book, Why Buddhism is True, he has this bit in it where he says, life is suffering, which is the Buddha apparently said that. But as with everything that's translated from ancient texts, the translation is a nearest closest, right? It's not the perfect word, and we don't necessarily know exactly what the words meant anyway. They're kind of created by looking at what they were in another sentence with and then work back in. And some scholars contest that the word dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A, isn't suffering, but unsatisfactoriness. Life is unsatisfactoriness. And as soon as you can accept the fact that inevitably you will be unsatisfied with a lot of the things which occur in life, you'll stop seeing them as a curse that's been bestowed on you, like some weird God has thrown some awful trials and tribulations that you need to deal with, and just accept it as part and parcel of life. You've thought about holiday for the last 6 months. You finally got away. You're there with your family. You're watching the sunset on the beach that you've looked at Instagram photos of 100 times before, and you're there and you're having the cocktail with your partner watching the sun go down. But there's a little bit of sand between your toes, and that's kind of a little bit irritating. And oh, this leg, the leg on the chairs is kind of just a little bit off. And I wish they'd put a bit more ice in this cocktail and this, this, and this. That is an inbuilt function of being a human. That is an inbuilt function, because if you were satisfied the first time that you had sex or the first time you killed a bison, you'd never have sex again and you'd never kill another bison. You can't have that. It needs to be that everything you do is just a little bit shitter than you thought it was going to be, because that is fitness enhancing to encourage you to continue to do the next thing. And this highlights why relying on goals and the hedonic adaptation, the hedonic treadmill that we all have, I will be happy when, I will be happy when, by using that, you are, it's guaranteed failure, because you won't be happy when. It's much easier for you to say, I will be unsatisfied when I get my promotion. I will be unsatisfied when I buy that new car and find out that I shouldn't have got cream leather seats. It should have been black. I get the new promotion and it's not the corner office. It doesn't have air conditioning. It's got a slow computer. The internet connection's bad. Da, 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 da. So that's the main takeaway. From
and it keeps us striving for more.
And then what are you meant to do? Like, what are you meant to do with that information? Or are you just meant to accept that?
Acceptance. Yeah.
I think trying to change
it. Be more
it
Karen.
Be a bit more Karen. Yeah. I'm not really too sure from that. Being aware of anything is the first sort of step toward being able to integrate it, right? Like, you need to understand what like doing a rep feels like before you can be let to go and design your own gym routine. And the same thing goes with this. I do think it's like one of the fundamental skills that you need to know. But yeah, life is unsatisfactoriness, man.
Yeah. I wonder if there's there's an element of it's supposed to be comforting in some ways, because I remember finding like this massive, I had this like one of these epiphany moments that I had came from this description of this song that I really, really love and always listen to this song. And then I read an interview about what the song was about, and it was basically based around this concept from a book which was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And it was the idea that true happiness comes from the realization that you will never truly be happy. Mm-hmm. And again, it sort of speaks back to what we're talking a little bit about goals about before, because I was at the time feeling this immense amount of pressure to kind of, you know, to be happy. And I'd just come out of medical school and I was like, this is rubbish. Like, I've just worked ages to do this job and it's the worst and it's miserable. And this idea that you don't have to be happy all the time, or that you don't have to be happy any of the time, that there is always going to be something that is stopping you from that true happiness, was actually bizarrely comforting. And I wonder if on like an existential / sort of philosophical level, whether we do find some comfort in that expectation. It's a bit like being given the 30 minutes, the 45 minutes, the 15 minutes thing. It's like, actually, don't worry. You might be miserable, but you're doing all right. Like, actually, that is, there's some comfort in that. I don't know.
We tend to think of like happiness as a destination rather than appreciate that it's moments in time. So almost you have to experience unhappiness to appreciate those happy little moments, rather than I'll be happy when end date. That's all I'm going to experience for the rest of my life now.
Very much so.
I think it's like structured fun. Like, you rarely have structured fun. It's same with happiness. Like, if you really try and plan something, you know, when someone goes to like real extremes and is like, no, these are the rules to the game and it'll be fun because we're all going to play it by the rules and that's the rules. It's not fun. Whereas when it's just a bit more free flowing, that's when fun happens. And that's probably the same.
Yeah. Some of my best uni nights out were the ones unplanned. They just happened.
So I've got a quote here from the Almanac of Naval Ravikant, which is what I was talking about.
I'm gonna get that. I listened to the podcast actually, and I meant to download
it. It's wonderful,
that.
Man.
Because you said it's a free PDF, isn't it?
Or you can buy it, and you can just get it for like Kindle optimized, all that stuff. Any end goal will just lead to another goal in life, lead to another goal. We just play games in life. When you grow up, you're playing the school game, or you're playing the social game. Then you're playing the money game, and then you're playing the status game. These games just have longer and longer lived horizons. At some point, at least, I believe, these are all just games. These are games where the outcomes really stop mattering once you see through the game. And when you get tired of games, I would say I'm at that stage where I'm tired of them. I just don't want there to be any end goal or purpose. I'm just living life as I want to, I'm literally just doing it moment to moment. And then he talks about, we've just been discussing there about sort of retirement and waiting to be happy. What you really want is freedom. You want freedom from your money problems. I think that's okay. Once you solve your money problems by lowering your lifestyle or making enough money, you want to retire. Not retirement at 65 years old, sitting in a nursing home, collecting a retirement check. It's a different definition. And he gets asked, what is your definition of retirement? Retirement is when you stop sacrificing today for an imaginary tomorrow. When today is complete, in and of itself, you're retired.
Oh,
boom, mic drop.
Yeah.
That was really brilliant. Good.
Yeah, it's cool.
So if/when you write a book, what will it be about?
Interesting that I've had a few calls recently about it. I already said my ability to focus is like saved purely by the fact that I get to, my work is having conversations and I can't procrastinate during the middle of one, apparently. My procrastination is yet to level up to the point at which it's made me procrastinate whilst I'm talking.
Was it you that was talking about that, about resistance, when you were talking about, on the podcast, about what your resistance is and the fact that if you're on a podcast, you can't have resistance.
You don't have resistance. No, yeah. I think that's, so resistance is a concept from The War of Art by... Stephen Pressfield.
Stephen Pressfield.
The War of Art. And basically everyone knows what it's like to sit down at a blank sheet of paper if you're a student or a writer or anyone basically that does stuff on their own. It's really, really hard. And he calls the difficulty you need to overcome resistance. But I think that you can game resistance by doing things with other people. So no one has ever done a CrossFit class and encountered resistance. Like, because the kill switch engage is playing at a level that makes your ears bleed and the coach is screaming in your face and everyone else is doing it. So you might as well do it. And even if you're in the worst mood in the world, you get in there and there's other people in there. Same as rugby training. No one stops during the middle of rugby training. It's like, well, the rest of the team's there and there's social accountability and all this sort of stuff. And similarly, podcasting is one of the few things, or having a conversation is one of the few things where resistance kind of gets pushed away, because it would just be weird for me to stop talking now. And just go off on a sort of odd little tangent. What was the question that we had before the...
What the book was going to be.
Oh, yeah. So I got... So I've had a couple of conversations about it, but the level of resistance I had would be so dense it would, like, swallow the earth. So I probably need to be fairly careful about that. If I was to do it, it would be something like How to Live a Consciously Designed Life. And the problem is that the word consciously designed life just makes it sound so awakened and wanky. But my point is that
so
everything that
brain fell out.
Yeah, everything that we've spoken about today, or a lot of the things that we've spoken about today, are to do with being fully aware and actualized when it comes to working out what you want and how to get it. A lot of the time, people, their desires in life are because of their genetic predisposition or their way they've dealt with past traumas or societal norms or what their parents expect of them or whatever it might be, their paths of least resistance, like laziness, all of that sort of stuff. Very few people actually lead a life where they want what they want to want. A lot of the time they want what their parents want them to want, or they want what society wants them to want, or they want what their genetics want them to want. Again, and as you read more of The Moral Animal and you learn about self-deception, you'll realize that even the things that you think you know about yourself are probably not true. They're just the genes playing with the toggles. So yeah, if I was to write a book, it would be trying to synthesize the things that I've learned, basically how to red pill yourself on as many different areas of your life as is possible, about why you feel this way about wealth, about why you feel this way about happiness, why you feel this way about your relationships with other people, your self-image, your confidence, all of this sort of stuff. And just like, look, this is what it is. This is why it's there. And here are some tactics that may allow you to kind of transcend this very up close and personal, the personal curse, as I sort of tend to call it, which is what our genes do, right? Our genes make us feel like the... like what sadness is. It feels crushing, you know, but it's just a bunch of chemicals in your brain. That bad, the negative self-talk that you give yourself, it isn't you. The thoughts that you have, you are not your thoughts. You're the person that listens to them. Like all of these sorts of things. So someone's got negative self-talk. They've dealt with it for their entire life. Maybe they had parents that were very critical of them when they were younger, or maybe they had an older brother, or they were bullied at school, or whatever it might be. Like the voice that you hear isn't you. You're the person that hears the voice. The voice that you hear is just this bullshit background, droning, boring, psychopathic, like weirdo that happens to be in your head. So you become aware of that. And then, okay, so what can we do? what can we do to get over that? So James Altucher's not useful trigger, which is every time he hears himself saying something that he doesn't like, he notices it, noting from a mindfulness meditation, labels it, again from mindfulness meditation, as not useful because it's not fucking useful, and then he lets it go. So he notices it arise in consciousness, notes it, and lets it go. And that's it. And maybe that is 1% of a way to help someone get past their negative self-talk. But if you had that across, you know, 50 different domains of life, and this is why you feel jealous about your partner, this is what jealousy was useful for in the past, but actually really think about what it's doing to you now. Or this is why you have blah, 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 blah. But I mean, that's basically trying to like create a rational framework for being a human, which is no small undertaking. And I'm in no way trained or qualified for it, so I don't know, that might just be a pipe dream.
That red pill, I guess, comes from
I've
heard you reference it before, that self-programming, but that has to come from that curiosity of oneself and that exploration. And that's the hard bit that no one really wants to do, because when you dig down deep into the back hidden parts of your psyche, it's uncomfortable. You know, you rediscover parts of yourself you don't really like, and then you have to verbalize that and you have to articulate it, and then you perhaps have to share that with other people. It's difficult stuff.
Yeah, I don't know, man, like for me personally, there is no greater joy than finding a bunch of different things linked, like a secret door in the house that you've lived in your whole life. You know, like you've lived in your head your entire life. And don't forget, like, for all that you might have a twin brother or twin sister, or you might have a partner you've been with since you were 15 years old, but like you were born and you're going to die alone. Like, so you better become friends with the person that's in your head. You'd better work out how to make life work for you. Because if you don't, like, it is like being trapped in solitary confinement with the most boring, repetitive, like just terrible crap friend ever, and you don't want that. Like, you deserve better. Everyone deserves better than that. So do the introspective work, and you know, again, if you have even a modicum of curiosity, finding out something about you that you didn't know was true previously, like as you read The Moral Animal and it's just mic drop after mic drop after mic drop, and the hairs stand up on the back of your neck and you go, holy shit, like that's why that's there. That's why that's there. I didn't even know I'd been there my entire life, and that's why that's there. Like, that's cool. And you know, if you're the sort of person that finds it easy, then you will, as you do more introspective work, it'll become easier and easier for you.
I'm totally stealing that. Don't be your own crap best friend.
Can I just ask another question as well? And I'm just interested to know this, because I think, like, again, what we talked about before, like you've developed clearly what is quite a lot of highbrow interest and quite a lot of highbrow discussion on things. And yet you've been through situations of like kind of, you know, TV, reality TV and that sort of stuff. How receptive are people who, because I think people often get like stereotyped and typecast, and in terms of what people want from people, can find it very difficult to transition into different sort of modes of thinking and different modes of what people want from them. How hard have you found that? Do you find it annoying when people bring up those experiences from the past? Do other people respond who know you from that time? Like, how have they responded to you, you know, putting out this sort of stuff rather than the similar sort of content that you would have been involved in at that sort of time?
Yeah, great, really great question. Tucker Max, who is the founder of the fratire genre and also the owner of Scribe Media, I had a podcast with him about this specific thing. He was this fuckboy guy who wrote about like shagging girls and throwing up in Vegas bathrooms and doing all this stuff for ages and ages and ages. And now is this hyper awakened family man with two beautiful daughters that he loves, and he's done MDMA psychotherapy and has been to therapy every day for like 7 years, and is just fully actualized and completely aware. And he talks about these epochs that we live our life in, right? Like, you're this person from 18 to 22, you're like a university mic, and then you're university mic, and then you're young doctor Mike, and then your young dad Mike, and then all the rest of this stuff. But a lot of the time, people are really scared. They just get a personality or a particular viewpoint in life or a particular way of being, and they just cling on to that because that's who they are and that's what they want to be. But for me personally, like, those different epochs are what makes it exciting. Like I want to have like an onion, or like when you cut a tree open, there's layers and layers and layers to it, right? Like the different layers are different stories. And as well, like the highbrow ideas and all this sort of stuff is great, but I'm a working class guy. I came from Stockton, Teesside, whose only claim to fame is the highest teen pregnancy rate in the UK. I went to a state primary, state secondary, Stockton sixth form college, and throughout all of school was like pretty mercilessly bullied for speaking a little bit differently. I didn't have the Middlesbrough twang. I played cricket, which is just like the most wanky bourgeois sport that you can come up with. And I was nowhere near equanimous enough to know that at the time that was just formative years, that really I just wasn't with like my people and it kind of didn't really matter so much. But I never compromised, which kind of makes me feel proud of younger me. I'm sure he would have been more popular if he had done, but I don't really mind. And then you get to uni and you're this person, and then big name on campus, and then you go do this thing and you go do that thing. I certainly think that it surprises people. I used to be called Chris Carnage Williamson on Facebook because Carnage was the first event that we ran, this big bar crawl thing, which some of the older viewers may remember. We wore a t-shirt and it had tasks on the back like pull a pig and like snogged three randoms and blah, blah, blah. And that was me. I was Carnage. Like all of the people from Geordie Shore will still, "All right, Carnage, how's it going?" Like that's still what they'll say to me when they see me, because we are imprinted by the first period that we know someone, and that's who they carry through for the rest of their life, you know. And yeah, I love it, man. I really, really enjoy people that listen to the show not knowing I was on Love Island, or people that knew me from back then not knowing that I do a podcast, or you know what I mean. Like being multifaceted is your competitive advantage, as far as I see it. Like you are a combination of your past experiences and your genetic heritage and your traumas and all the rest of that stuff. So like embrace it, like embrace being as weird as possible, because that means that it's impossible to clone you. If anyone else can train someone to be you, you're disposable. But if no one else can be trained to be you, that is your competitive advantage. And that's what permits me to sit down and ask Sienna Day about how you prep for anal when you've got two Amsterdamian black men waiting in the wings to film you on a Brazzers scene, and then go and talk to Tiago Forte about his most effective productivity hacks. Like, because I want to know both of those things. And because the next podcaster that came along might not have the working class background. So if I compromise that side, the ability of being able to, that I've developed of working on the front door of nightclubs for 14 years and talking to like drunkards and pissheads, like if I don't utilize the ability to do that and be personable with people on that level, that's me. I'm like losing some of the weirdness. I'm losing some of the uniqueness. So yeah, I get what you mean, that having a multifaceted, but even the fact that you recognize that makes me a little bit sad, because it's like, that is an oddity to find someone who has gone through multiple different epochs in their life. Like most people find their pigeonhole and then just drill further and further and further down into it. And maybe some people do like look upon the perfectly actualized, aligned version of themselves at like 18 years old. I don't think most of us do. I think most of us like just get it wrong and then get it a bit less wrong. And then, oh shit, I got it really wrong. Let's get back. And then I get it a bit less wrong. And then eventually you kind of, you vacillate so much until you find a relative set point. But yeah, man, like that's, again, that's
a typical thing, like, isn't it? That if I turned around to Mike and I was like, "You've changed," that would deem to be like a negative thing, right? Mm. You're not the person that you used to be. Mm. And it's like, of course, like, yeah, I have changed since school. Like, of course I have. Like, yeah. And I'd hope that I had. And
There's a
I think
photo.
We do often see that as like, you should be the same person you were when we were kids, and it's like, no, I've had life experience.
Why is that there? That's there because other people say, I want to put you into a hole, I want to put you into a particular archetypal pigeonhole box, and I don't want you to move out of that, because that's confusing to me, because it requires me to, it makes me feel uncomfortable because you've shown growth. Maybe I'm not happy with who I am. But on top of that as well, like, we just like to be able to define people easily. Mm. And when someone breaks that mold, like, we still live, this is another Jordan Petersonism, we still live in archetypes, you know, like the jock, the maiden, the villain, the redeemed, like the quiet, arty type, the this type, the nerd, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And we just want to put people into that. But again, if I know one thing about you, or two things about you, or a couple of your views, and I can extrapolate out the rest of your personality and life interests from those two things. You're not a unique individual. No. You're just this like cookie cutter prefabricated like version, like amorphous vanilla version of a human, which who hasn't actually ended up taking all of their experiences and using them properly.
No, I totally agree.
That's wow. a fantastic takeaway for everyone listening, actually. Yeah.
That was amazing. I've very much enjoyed this podcast. Thank you very much for your time.
I feel like I've enjoyed the podcast, but possibly can just drive up and have a beer at some point, Chris.
Well, I mean, we're going to really struggle to do that at the moment. But yeah, man, I've enjoyed it as well. I think you guys are doing really good work here. I really love the channel.
Oh, thank you.
Likewise.
You need that from us. But I will pick your brains on. I'm really curious about self-deception, so I will message you and ask you about that another time.
Absolutely.
Selfishly.
Maybe podcast part two someday. Who knows?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm ready. I'm ready whenever you guys are.
Incredible.
Thank you for your time, mate.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys.
And just before we go, where can people find out more about you if they don't know already? Sorry, Em.
No, I was like, why did I not say that? Yeah, go. Tell us all. I mean, I just assume everyone listens to Modern Wisdom, but also you've got your personal Instagram as well.
Correct, yeah. So Modern Wisdom, wherever you're listening to this, go and check that out if you enjoyed this, or YouTube. Chris Will X, which is the reason why everyone's getting my surname wrong, at Chris Will X on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, not TikTok. And that's it. Reach out if you enjoyed it. I have a free life hacks list, chriswillx.com/lifehacks, which details 200 ways that you can upgrade your life, and it's free. So you can go and get that. And yeah, that's it. If you enjoyed what I spouted today, then you may enjoy me being much more silent on my show and allowing other smart people to have their say.
Well, I have to say it was lovely hearing the other side, because I listen to a lot of Modern Wisdom, but then you know, you obviously you get bits of your experiences, but the whole point is you're having a guest on to talk about their experiences. So it's been very insightful.
Thank you.
It's nice to be on the other side of the mic for once.
Yeah.